Good morning. I'm Veronica Rickert. Glad to be with you this morning on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm in this week for Kathleen Dunn. With midterm elections down the road this fall, President Obama's approval ratings are less than stellar, and grumblings from the populace about the economy's slow recovery, Democrats are bracing themselves for a hit. Traditionally, it's the president's job to get out and hustle for his party, to raise money and lend razzle-dazzle to the proceedings in the midterms. But Barack Obama isn't your usual politician. In fact, his reluctance to blame Republicans for the country's problems and his faith in new politics have left Democrats wondering if he's partisan enough to help them this November. Matt Bye takes up the question in the recent article Democrat in Chief, which ran last weekend in the New York Times Magazine. And we're happy to hear from you this morning. Is President Obama doing his part to help Democrats in the midterms? Is he actually able to help, given his own radical election strategy, relying on volunteers and independent voters and not TV ads and core constituents? The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, or you can send your email to talk@WPR.org. And Matt Bye, good to have you with us.
Hi, nice to be here, Veronica. How's things there?
Things are good. How about you?
Oh, we're all right, thanks. Summer in Washington.
Hot? Sticky?
Yeah, hot, but at least we have no oil on the shore, so we're
right.
Okay.
Well, yeah, so far, right?
So far.
Well, you know, midterms are coming up fast. It's not too soon to start thinking about that. What's at stake for Democrats?
You know, what's at stake in the obvious sense is power, control of the agenda. You know, there's a decent chance that Democrats could lose the House of Representatives. There's a very outside chance, I would say, particularly in light of recent primaries, that Republicans could also overtake the Senate. But surely in this environment, if the president lost control of one chamber, his agenda would be, in all likelihood, paralyzed, and it would be very hard for him to get control of the last 2 years of his presidency. Now, we could have a more interesting discussion, perhaps, about an argument, perhaps, about whether he is helped or hurt by losing a large number of seats. Democrats are going to lose a large number of seats, and I, for one, have written in the past, and I still believe that he will be better off losing a decent share of those seats in terms of trying to navigate his way through Congress and build coalitions with both parties. But I think if he were to lose control of that chamber, it would be very, very difficult.
Well, among the ranks, Democrats, including Nancy Pelosi, have been grumbling about Obama's message, which in the recent past has seemed to be that Washington is broken. And their take is that a broken Washington doesn't really help Democrats get elected in November. What else are they objecting to there?
Well, what they want is for the president to really make a strong, vigorous case against Republican ideas or the lack thereof. I mean, what they hear the president running around saying, as you say, Washington is broken, Washington is a problem, you know, sympathizing with the feeling that voters have that the entire system doesn't work. And what the Democrats on the Hill are saying is, we are the system, and you're talking about us, and you need to go out there and say, my party is doing the right thing, but the opposition party is not. You know, specifically, they want him to really make the case, because he has the forum to do that, that given their choice, Republicans would take the country back to the policies of the Bush era, including privatizing Social Security and runaway spending and repealing the health care law and a variety of other things, some of which have been proposed by Republicans recently. I think you've seen the president do this more lately. He has given a couple of highly partisan speeches in response to a lot of pressure, I think, from the Hill. But it's interesting to watch where the audiences are for those speeches. One of them was at, actually, a congressional candidate's dinner in New York. And one of them was not a big press event, but was kind of picked up on later. So I think he's trying to walk a careful line here. I don't think that's the message that they feel benefits his presidency the most, but I think he's going to try to do some amount of that rhetoric in order to comply with the wishes of his Democratic allies.
Well, you can understand how it would be kind of a sticky wicket for him, because he campaigned as being the post-partisan politics guy, and come midterms, you can't really be post-partisan, I guess. You have to be in there with your party.
Well, that's right, and that's what really moved me to write about this subject and think about it and talk to people, because it is an interesting conflict. Not only did President Obama campaign as a guy who was going to lessen the partisan distinction and partisan division in Washington rather than mark the triumph of one party over another, I don't think he could have known when he was campaigning the kinds of majorities he would ultimately end up with in Congress. But he also, I think, believes that. I think temperamentally and personally, he is a deal maker and a conciliator. I think he believes that the sort of cultural divisions that a lot of us grew up with in our politics are counterproductive. And that, partisanship only deepens that. So I think that is, where his heart is and where his head is, certainly where he campaigned. And then you come to a midterm election, which is all about party and all about a president making the case for his party and trying to augment the numbers that he has to work with in the Congress. And so there is a natural conflict there for him. And I think at bottom, this is what I wrote about in the magazine, at bottom I just don't think he perceives of himself as a party leader, nor has much appetite to go out and be the Democratic leader as much as he does simply, to be the president.
Right, and Rahm Emanuel seems to be the one who's crunching the numbers, poring over the polls and the electoral maps. So how invested do you think Obama is in getting Democrats elected?
Well, I think he's invested not as much as other presidents. I mean, I think he's invested to the extent that he has a couple of goals, right? One is, as I said earlier, he doesn't want to lose a chamber of Congress. And I think he'd rather, given the choice, he'd rather not have a tiny margin of control in the House, which is likely what's likely going to happen, I think, or a tiny margin in the Senate. He knows they could lose the House. In fact, our most Democratic strategists in town right now would tell you that they will lose the House, I think, if they were being honest about it. And so I think he wants to avoid that fate for sure. He also wants to get his agenda through with his own party, and that means that even if Democrats continue to control Congress, they need to feel good about him, and they need to feel that they owe him something. And to the extent that the president isn't seen as there for them in the midterms, he will have a harder time calling in that support later on. So he needs to be there for his party, and he understands that. But he's not what they won't do, I think, and this is what's different from past presidencies, is they won't have the president behaving in a way, acting in a way as a party leader that subverts his brand. And his brand is not the party. His brand is about, as we talked about, this post-partisanship, this transcendence, this idea that he's not a guy who practices petty partisan politics. So to the extent that the party needs or wants him to do things that are traditionally political, these sort of chicken dinners, what they call the Jefferson-Jackson dinners in the Democratic Party that are mostly for activists or donors, robocalls, although he'll probably do a few of those, I would guess, before the campaign is over, these kind of automated phone calls, the rhetoric that they're demanding from him in public that would be highly partisan, attacking the Republican opposition. I think that they will draw a line there so that at the end of the day, even if he keeps his majorities, he does not appear to have tossed away the sort of credibility as someone above the fray of partisan politics that they think he built up during the presidential campaign.
Well, he got all those independents into the polls. They kind of swept him in with surprising force. And I guess he must already be thinking about whether they will still be there for him in the next election. So I guess by staying a little bit above the partisan fray, he's trying to play it safe and not alienate them.
Yes, but it's tricky because, the math of that election is very tricky to parse. There were, as I would break it down, there were two trends that really made Barack Obama so successful. And remember, he's only the fourth Democrat, I think he's the fourth Democrat in history to win with more than 51% of the vote, right? And the first since Lyndon Johnson. So, I mean, he changed the math in a significant way. One way in which they did that, as you correctly point out, Veronica, is the independents who voted for him in much greater numbers than they voted for, say, John Kerry or Al Gore. The other way he did it was in what they call the surge voters, and that is the sense of bringing in a lot of new voters, unregistered voters, voters who had dropped off, who'd never really voted, younger voters, African-American voters, Latino voters, people into the process, and that, created literally a larger electorate. The independents are effectively gone from the Democratic Party at this point. There is no poll that I know of that shows independents sticking with the party through this midterm election. They may or may not come back to the president in 2012, But that's not going to get it done this year. So the big focus here is on these surge voters, on these new voters. And the big question around this election is, can President Obama bring his voters, the people who came out for him but not for the party, who didn't feel moved to vote before, can he bring those people to the polls to vote for their congressmen and their senators in 2010?
It seems a kind of a question of, can they get lightning to strike twice?
Right.
This is the way it worked for Obama, but is that a repeatable pattern?
That, you know, you've hit the exact question, right? Is it lightning striking twice, or has something fundamental changed in the electorate? And you get very different answers as you talk to different people. There's a real question about this, right? I mean, on one hand, we know that we're living in a slightly different moment than we used to be. The endorsement matters less. Appeal is less transferable. It's just not clear that the president can go out and say to people who supported him, please go vote for this guy who's been in Congress for 30 years, you know, who's 20 years older than I am, who's white, who's, you know, who's perhaps been more conservative, or, you know, whatever. It's, you know, go out and vote for this guy. I mean, it's not clear. In fact, I would think it's very unlikely that the president can sway a lot of voters in that particular way. The question is whether the tactics, I think, of the Obama campaign in 2008 can be applied to midterms in 2010. And that is, how much of that bringing in of the surge vote in 2008, these new voters, was about organizing on the ground, enlisting volunteers, creating a strong, solid organization, and how much can you get congressional and Senate campaigns to change the way they do business so that they, too, are doing more of a grassroots kind of campaign. The White House believes that if they do that, that if they learn from the model of the campaign, they will have a much greater chance of success in bringing these voters to the polls. But as you point out, the counter view, and I think there's a lot of validity to it, is, well, that was easy for President Obama to do because he generated all of this enthusiasm and passion and excitement. But I don't care how well you build an organization, you have got to inspire people on some kind of base level if you want to literally change the math of the electorate.
Right, and you can imagine some of these older Democrats who do not have the unique political stance that Barack Obama has as the first African-American presidential candidate. You can imagine them going, you mean I'm going to spend my money on a bunch of volunteers instead of a TV
right.
ad?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the other thing is about resources. I mean, look, leave aside for the moment that if you're running, you may have been in Congress for 25, 30 years. You may not have had a competitive race for 25 or 30 years. So the world has changed and you don't know it, right? It's very hard to get some of these guys' heads around how campaigning is changing because, you know, they really haven't run a competitive race in a long time. But even leaving that aside, just talking about the resources, which is the question you raised, I mean, look, Barack Obama, for all the advantages they had in 2008, beginning with, you know, the strength of the candidate, they also had all the resources you could possibly want. I mean, because he generated such excitement, particularly online, because he had all these small-dollar contributions. I mean, look, at the end of the day, between the primary and the general election, they raised, I think, about $750 million. And that meant that if you want to you could talk about organizing and door-to-door and all this stuff. That's great because they had paid organizers, hundreds of them, organizers in every state, in addition to the television ads, right, in addition to the Internet operation, in addition to every other kind of campaign operation, yard signs and video game ads. They could do whatever they wanted. There were no choices. Most campaigns have to make choices, particularly if you're running for Congress or the Senate. If you're telling a senator, look, you should hire a dozen organizers to go around your state and build an Obama-like organization, you're also telling him that he should run X number fewer advertisements on television. And that is a choice. It is an allocation of precious resources, and it's very hard to get candidates to do that when one method is what they've been doing their entire career and the other is kind of a crapshoot.
What do you think Barack Obama's sense of his obligation to Democrats is? Do you think that he's feeling that he can be a bit of a free flyer and do his own thing because that was, after all, his party platform or his platform when he ran? Or do you think he does feel that he owes a lot to them and he needs to perform?
Well, I don't know that anyone knows the exact answer to your question. I mean, I would have liked to ask the president that directly, and I made that request very directly, and they did not want him talking about politics for all the reasons, you know, because that's not his brand. I think here's how I would boil down. Here's my answer to that question, and I think it's accurate, which is, you know, it's not a black and white thing. I would not say the president doesn't care if his party wins or loses. He's not a party guy. Nor would I say, you know, the president is cares about nothing so much as democratic rule. I think he cares about helping his party and his allies, building goodwill, getting his majorities, keeping control. He cares about all of that as much as he can, up to the point where it subverts his personal appeal and brand with independents and voters, and up to the point where it makes him less of an independent figure, sort of above the fray. And when those two things come in conflict, when the party needs from him something that makes him more of a party leader, the kind of guy with the straw hats and the placards and all of that from the last era, and less of his own self-contained political enterprise, then I think that's where the answer comes back as no, he won't go that far. So I think he'd love for his party to win. I think he'll do what he feels he can for his party, but only up until the point where it serves his interests as well. I don't think he's going to subvert his interests electorally in 2012 or as a figure trying to govern the country in the service of getting his party elected. And I guess the difference there is that past presidents probably would have felt that getting their party's majorities solidified in Congress was tantamount to having a successful presidency, and I don't think he sees it that way.
Well, if the Democrats do wind up taking a beating in the midterm elections and some of this comes back to roost on his doorstep, is there a chance that this could come back to bite him if he's seen as not doing enough now in his election 2 years from now?
No, absolutely. Yeah, I think, these are the gambles you take. It can bite him in myriad ways. I mean, as I started out saying, if he loses the House, he's not going to get anything done. Republicans are going to be in no mood to move any part of his agenda prior to the 2012 election. If he keeps the House, but the perception is that he did too little and they barely sort of skated by, I think it's going to be hard to get Democrats to make tough votes. I mean, this has been a problem, I think, for the president, a subtext and a problem for the president right from day one, which is congressmen and senators make tough votes for the president when they feel the president can help them in some way. And I think this president has always understood that, he can't help a lot lawmakers in some parts of the country where he just isn't as popular, and B, that he's not seen as a transferable commodity. It's not like this president can show up in your district and hold your hand and he's going to get you over the finish line or change a lot of minds, because he is this self-contained politician. His appeal is really about him. It's not really so much about the party. So I think, to the extent that he's not there or not seen to be there for congressmen or senators, if they walk away from this midterm election, win or lose, feeling as if he didn't go to the mat for them, I think it's going to be harder to get a lot of them to go to the mat for his agenda.
Well, it's time for our first break right now, and then we'll come back and keep talking with Matt Bai about his recent article, Democrat in Chief, which ran last weekend in the New York Times Magazine. And we're happy to take your phone call this morning. Do you think President Obama is doing his part to help Democrats win the midterm elections, or do you prefer to see him staying a bit above the fray there? Is he actually able to help, given his own election strategy? Our number to call, 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, or you can shoot us an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, in for Kathleen Dunn, on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert, back with you this morning on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, as we talk with Matt Bai, national political columnist for the New York Times and a regular contributor to the New York Times Magazine. He wrote the recent article, Democrat in Chief, and we're asking you this morning, do you want to see President Obama being more partisan to help his fellow Democrats in the coming midterm elections? Or are you happy seeing him sort of reflecting that post-partisan platform that helped get him elected? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. And we go to our first phone call now. We've got Gary joining us from Fitchburg. Hi, Gary.
Good morning.
Morning.
If you would allow me to make a couple points, I've followed Democratic and geopolitical politics, in world events for 50 years, and have been involved in campaigns. And Obama painted himself as being a progressive with lots of progressive rhetoric. He was able to, for the first time in a long time, get a lot of young people involved in supporting him. However, if you look at the money that was backing Obama and the corporate media empire that gave him such pity-pat treatment through the campaign, it was a red flag for me. And I think the bankers and the military-industrial complex have their man in there. He's not one of us. He's not a progressive. He's masquerading as a progressive. In actuality, he was a Trojan horse put in, I think, really to decimate the Democratic Party. And I think that's what's going to happen. He's not a progressive Democrat. He is a banker, military-industrial complex, shill, con man, and most people have figured him out.
Well, Gary, you're touching on some of the concerns that other people have had about whether Barack Obama is blue enough that he came to us as sort of an unknown commodity, and we're still seeing how that's going to play out. What do you think, Matt Bai?
Well, I mean, I would say a couple of things to Gary, and he wouldn't like any of them. But I don't, first of all, you do hear a complaint. I mean, there is an increasing breach between, progressives in the party and the president, and I'm actually getting ready to write a column about this at some point, probably next week. But, first of all, just on the basis of what this president has accomplished, I mean, unless you have a really utopian worldview and can settle for nothing less than the perfect ideal as a progressive, which I suppose does define some segment of the party, this president has enacted the most sweeping social legislation since the 1960s in healthcare, and arguably the most transformative since Franklin Roosevelt. He has just designed and will pass an entire re-regulation of the financial system, not perhaps as radical as some people would like, but quite significant. He spent $800 billion in public spending, a lot of it to completely overhaul public spending on education, a lot of it to invest more money than the government has ever invested in new forms of energy. I mean, to argue that this president has not had a progressive administration, to me, is just to argue with the facts. I mean, one can say it's not what he should be doing or not enough, but he's clearly not a tool of corporate interest, and he's clearly had a very progressive administration. I think a lot of this, the second thing I would say is I think a lot of this really is generational. If you look at the polling on Barack Obama, forget left and right for a moment. Now, there's a fascinating thing I was looking at in a Pew poll, and it really caught my attention, because as you go down on the education level, that is, as you get to, say, high school educations, his support drops. But if you go down on the income level, his support goes up. And I said to Andy Cohut, who's the head of the Pew Research Center, what's going on here? Shouldn't people with less education and less income correlate in their views of the president? And he said, no, it's all about age. It's all about generation. The lower income bracket actually takes into account a lot of younger voters who really like him but aren't making a lot of money yet. And the lower education bracket takes into account a lot of older voters who didn't get college education and so but are making more money. Because they're, they've been working jobs for a long period of time. So, a lot of the breakdown of support in this president is less about ideology, it's less about race, it's less about a lot of these things, although they're all pieces of it. It's really about age. And even in his own party, I think this is true, that, Gary I don't think he gave his age, but I'm going to guess he's of a certain generation of Democratic activists who have a very set idea of what progressivism means and have been carrying a very set sense of both what they want to accomplish and their aggrievement at what the system has done to them for decades. And Barack Obama represents, I think, a different generation and a different way of looking at both politics and progressivism. And a lot of the divide over where this president is has to do with where you came into the movie and what you think the goal of politics and government ought to be.
Well, thank you for your call, Gary. We appreciate it. And moving to Bill in Toma. Hi, Bill.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'm an alien. I'm just passing through and listening to your talk. Wasn't there a kind of a shocking upset in New Hampshire, or was it Massachusetts? and there were some pundits thinking that maybe the president didn't help candidate there, the Democratic candidate. And maybe there's lots of Democratic candidates that don't want him in their campaign. Just like to hear the author's comments.
All right. Well, thank you, Bill. Matt Bye.
Well, thanks, Bill. I like Tomah very much. I've been there a bunch of times, actually.
Really?
Yeah, I did a story up there once, and it was a nice steakhouse up there. I spent a good deal of time in with Ed Thompson, the former governor's brother. So
okay.
I'm a big fan. You're talking about the Massachusetts election of Scott Brown to the Senate, which was Ted Kennedy's former seat before his death, and it was a watershed election. The president didn't get involved in that election, didn't really want to at that point get involved in state elections and congressional elections, and only too late did they realize that things were going sour, and not only were they going to lose Ted Kennedy's seat, but they were going to lose the 60th vote they needed on health care, and the president was very, very frustrated. And when they lost that seat, it really was, you know, if you talk to Democrats in Washington, they'll tell you it really was a wake-up call. I mean, that they really did, the White House and other Democrats really did see, hey, we're in trouble here. There's a lot of anger out there. And if we don't have a plan and we don't get the president involved, we're going to lose Congress. And they will tell you, and this is a little bit of spin, but I think there's some reality to it. They will tell you that there was a real positive to that, because in 1994, say, which was a very different election, I don't want to make a strong comparison, but in 1994, Democrats and Bill Clinton and the White House really did not see the intensity of the public dissatisfaction until very late in the election season, far too late to do much about it, and actually the leaders in Congress never saw it and did not embrace any kind of reform message. And, you know, that what the Massachusetts special election did is, you know, almost a year out from the midterm elections, it really gave Democrats a very strong jolt and forced them to see what they were up against.
Okay, well, thank you so much for your call, Bill. And on to Rich, joining us from Sullivan. Welcome, Rich.
Good morning.
Morning.
I was explaining to your screener that I voted for Barack Obama, and I find him intellectually just a superb thinker. I also find him wanting greatly in the area of emotional intelligence that many people these days are commenting on the Tea Party movement and Sarah Palin rallying around candidates and making a difference. And they'll express amazement that, what is it about this character? And I'm just using the word character not to disparage Ms. Palin, but to simply say she has a commanding persona that many voters relate to. And in a time when unemployment is at record highs, and people see not just themselves from my generation, but their children and their grandchildren looking at a future that seems very unpromising indeed in terms of careers and income levels. A guy gets on TV last night and talks to us as though he really cares, but as far as I'm concerned, watching him, the only person he's leading is himself. And your guest can call real reform radical all he wants, but you can compromise and compromise and compromise and compromise yourself out of commitment from the voters who really thought you were thinking about them and their families. And I just find Barack Obama coming across as an extremely emotionally weak person.
Well, thank you for your call, Rich. We touched on this a little bit yesterday when we were talking about voter dissatisfaction, or I guess not voter dissatisfaction, but dissatisfaction over Obama's response to the oil crisis, people thinking he seemed a little emotionally remote. What do you think about the, emotional intelligence factor, Matt Bye?
Yeah, the sort of what a colleague of mine calls the Spock factor, right? I think Rich puts his finger on the danger for this president, and I have to admit, I watched the speech and I looked at the pictures, the visuals today in the paper, and I thought to myself, this is becoming now a really a sort of existential threat to his presidency, which is, you know, and I hesitate to make this comparison. People are doing it a lot lately, and we can be too facile about it. There's a huge difference between Barack Obama and Jimmy Carter, not least of which is what President Obama has managed to achieve at this point. But the one thing is that I've always found instructive about Carter, if you go back and look at the polling on it, is that even at his lowest moment, even when people had completely lost faith in him, and it was clear his presidency was fatally wounded, people thought Carter was a good guy and a trustworthy guy, and he got very high marks for his integrity and likability. They just didn't think he was a leader. And I think, you know, President Obama's not at that point, but if I were sitting in the White House, and it's good for everyone I'm not, because I'd be a lousy strategist, wouldn't have much interest in it, but if I were sitting in the White House, I would have to think that this is what concerns me, right? That people still sort of believe in him personally, but there's a perception taking hold that he may not be a strong enough leader. And I'm not sure what you do about that, because I think part of it is just the media moment we live in, how fractured it is, how difficult it is to command. I mean, we talk about the commanding persona of a Ronald Reagan, let's say. But, you know, or even a Bill Clinton at moments in his presidency. But we live in a vastly different media environment in the Internet age. There's a million, there's a wave of commentary that drowns out everything you say. There's a million ways that your comments, your public appearances get sliced and diced. Everything appears in small bites. I think it's very, very hard to project the image you want to project or to make an extended argument in this environment. And I think they're trying to figure out, you know, how best to do that. I would say, well, Rich's point about, you know, real reform, I disparage real reform. I mean, look, the only thing I would say to frustrated liberals about this is, and again, I think it embodies a certain generation, a certain sort of boomer era generation of liberals. You know, I don't know where they think. I think they believe that with and there are a lot of people in Washington who believe this, that with big Democratic majorities, right, that you would get all the most sort of far-reaching, expansive liberal legislation you'd been hoping for. That's just never happened in the country. I mean, there's a myth here that has perverted the way people look at progressive politics. The civil rights era of politics, the Great Society of Lyndon Johnson, was not passed with a liberal, with a liberal tide of reform. It was passed on the backs of segregation. It was passed with Republicans, just as Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal was balanced on the backs of segregationists. It was basically passed with the segregationist South and conservatives. So there's always been compromise. There's always been cross-party coalition or cross-ideological coalition. It's simply not in the cards in American politics to walk in with any number of majority or with however progressive a president you have and pass the most farthest-reaching ideal progressive legislation you can dream up. That's just not happened. And so, I think this president, he's not dealing with the constraints of his moment. He's dealing with the constraints that have throughout history been a constant in American politics. And to hold him accountable for that, to say, you know, that somehow his level of compromise is a sellout, it just seems to me to be a denial of all history. It's just making up history. It's not looking at the reality at all.
Well, it seems to me that part of the problem is also that voters wanted a president who transcended Washington politics. They liked the idea of post-partisan politics, but we don't know what that looks like. It's a completely foreign idea, I guess, a president who might be actually trying to embody that. Progressives, liberals, conservatives, right. Don't know what to expect. What does that look like?
Oh, I think that's exactly right, Veronica. And I think in this case, ironically, my own feeling is that part of the problem here has been the size of the majorities he actually got. That I think the president, when he talked about post-partisanship, when he talked about shifting the paradigm from the past, I think he really envisioned himself as a coalition builder, as someone who could rally Democrats and Republicans, some number of them, around a series of sort of forward-looking solutions. And, you know, part of the dynamic, you know, he's been called naive for that, and maybe it was, but part of the dynamic he inherited as a result of the scope of the Democratic victory in 2008 was that he has a Democratic Party that is so, has such great numbers in Washington that it feels no need to compromise, and a Republican minority, at least in the leadership end, and a Republican minority that is so marginalized and represents such a small ideological slice of the country that there's no one there to deal with, right? All the moderate Republicans got bounced out. So he's gotten zero support on the Republican side. All of his overtures have basically been rebuffed. And on the Democratic side, he's constantly, you know, getting hammered for not being sort of sweeping enough, even though, you know, to pass anything really through the Senate, you really have to make some level of compromises even within your own caucus. So I think it's been an almost impossible environment to try and do the kind of coalition building he envisioned himself doing. And ironically, I think were he to lose some seats but retain control, such that to pass legislation through the House or through the Senate, you really needed to have some amount of Republican support, and you had more Republicans filling those seats from more moderate districts, he might, you know, be able to make a start on sort of making that a reality. I mean, I think the classic example here is Scott Brown, who we talked about from Massachusetts, who's now crossed the line, been the first Republican to cross the line on a couple of major votes and support the president's position. Now, why does Scott Brown do that? Because he can read a poll, I presume, and in Massachusetts, which is a pretty moderate state, you know, you can't just say no all the time. It's not like being from Oklahoma or being from Utah. And so I think, you know, to the extent that more Republicans represent a wider array of the country, you might get the kind of Republicans in office with whom you could build that kind of post-partisan coalition. But you can't do it right now.
Well, time for another break right now as we talk this morning with Matt Bai, who wrote the recent article Democrat in Chief, which ran last weekend in the New York Times Magazine. And we're happy to take your phone call this morning as well. Do you think President Obama is doing enough to help Democrats in the midterms? Do you think he's actually able to help, given his own unique election strategy? Well, the number to call is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. And our email is talk@WPR.org. I'm Veronica Rickert with you on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert back with you on Wisconsin Public Radio as we talk with Matt Bai, national political columnist for the New York Times and a regular contributor to the New York Times Magazine. He wrote the recent article Democrat in Chief. Taking our next call right now, Sarah is joining us from Zion. Hey, Sarah.
Hi there. Hi, I was just listening to the comment you made, the guest made a few minutes ago, and I don't feel like he's a sellout, but I have been somewhat disappointed, and I feel like he could just be bolder and seize the moment and do something that people haven't done before. And you're saying that no visionary legislation has ever been passed just because there was a Democratic majority, and I'm wondering, was there ever such a big Democratic majority like Obama had? And and to say that just because it hasn't happened before, I mean, you're saying, well, you just don't understand history. Well, people do things that have never been done before a lot, and that's how amazing things happen. And just to say that it hasn't happened is not to say that it couldn't happen now. And I don't really expect him to be this messiah and fix everything and give me all my dreams, but it does seem like he could be a lot bolder.
Well, I mean, that's an interesting point, sir. I mean, there was a difference, right, between boldness and ideology to some extent. You know, what I'm talking about ideology is I'm saying, yes, there have been large Democratic majorities in the 1930s, you know, pretty much uninterrupted with one period in the 1950s, but more or less uninterrupted into the 1990s. But, you know, at the greatest moment, the greatest periods in that time, say in the 1930s with the sweeping legislation of the New Deal, you know, that was a compromise with segregationists in the South and the Democratic Party. And in the 1960s, that was a really a cross-party coalition. So, you know, my point is in terms of classically liberal legislation. It would be a mistake to think that there's ever been this great liberal wave in America that passed all of this legislation. You need partners, and sometimes those partners are odious, and that's the history. And I don't think there's any reason to think that's suddenly changed here. I don't think Barack Obama's election, there's no reason to believe that Barack Obama's election was in fact a mandate for some sort of liberal renaissance in America. There's nothing in the polling or anecdotally in my experience out on the campaign and talking to voters, there's nothing about that election, I think, that indicates that that's what it was. But the word boldness that Sarah uses is actually a different thing. I mean, this is a question of, you know, why can't he think differently about the future, right? Why hasn't he sort of broken with the past and, you know, come out and, you know, and tried to challenge both parties, really just try to challenge the orthodoxies of the day, right? I mean, when they did health care, you know, I think they got a very progressive, transformative bill. But where was the talk about portability? Where was the notion that, you know, the entire employee-based system was outdated and could not sustain itself? I mean, have we fixed the 20th century healthcare issues just as we embark on the 21st, right? I mean, these are really important questions. And I actually think part of the problem here, I think, for the president, to give him some credit here or some sympathy, I think part of the problem is his own majority in Congress, because, you know, the average age of a committee chairman in the Democratic Congress is something like, at least when he came into office, was, I think, 69.7. Hmm. I had this number at some point, right? I mean, there is a generation of leadership on the Hill in seniority who have been invested in the same solutions and the same systems for a very long time. And they have an agenda. And I think it's very hard for Barack Obama to come in, even if he sees clearly into the future and sees that orthodoxies on neither side make a ton of sense. I think it's very hard for him to sell his own majority on some radical or bold departure from the past. But I do think you could certainly fault him for having fallen back on sort of older arguments and older ideologies that are less bold than maybe the country should be thinking about as we, you know, go into such a vastly different period.
Well, thank you so much for your call, Sarah. And we move to Pat in Oconomowoc. Hey, Pat.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Good.
Veronica, I think you hit it on the head a little bit earlier regarding the transparency, you know, post-racial, changing Washington. I was actually John McCain supporter. I voted for him. But I had to admit that the campaign that was run by Barack Obama was unbelievable. And actually, as I'm driving through Madison right here, I see an Obama 08 sticker, you know, on the car in front of me. But just thinking back a year and a half, you know, how much has changed? And I really think the big mistake he made was the stimulus bill. And really, the Republicans, because of the large Democrat majority, honestly, were shut out. They were shut out of that process. And, you know, Rahm Emanuel's comment, never let a good crisis go to waste. Well, what we saw was an $800 billion package that really did shore up the public sector, which we needed to a certain extent. But we were promised that, you know, unemployment would not go above 8% if we went ahead and enacted this legislation. This money would be timely and targeted, which we look at it today and there's still $300 billion not spent. It didn't really do anything for the private sector. You know, we spent money on cash for clunkers, the $7,000, $8,000 new tax credit. Now we're talking about a $90 billion bill for teachers. It's been spending after spending after spending. And I think, you know, by shutting the Republicans out of that initial process, it turned off a lot of those independents and definitely the conservatives that did cross over and vote for Barack Obama, because they thought things would be different. And then I don't want to take all your time, but we moved into the health care bill with the backroom deals, the most recent issues with him offering jobs or his administration offering jobs, and it's just to a few people not to run in the primary. And it's like nothing's changed. If anything, the Chicago-style politics in the administration, it's almost worse.
So you think if he had been more inclusive of Republicans from square one, from that stimulus bill, that we'd be looking at a different game, I don't know, right now. Matt Bai, what do you think?
Well, it was a little more complicated than that, although I think there's some basis to it. I mean, there's no question that Democrats on the Hill intended to and did shut out their Republican opponents, for all intents and purposes, early on. I mean, there's so much ill feeling from the Bush era. They'd been pushed around so much. They didn't want to play politics with it. They thought they'd been given this mandate by the voters. There's no question that that happened. I mean, it is also true, and the president, I think, was very, very stung by this, that when the president went to the Hill to meet with those Republicans during the process, they made a decision sitting in the room that that no one would support that bill before he ever walked into the room, and he only found out about it later, and he was very, very burned by that, and I think it changed his attitude about reaching out to Republicans after that. So this is a little bit of a two-way street, but definitely something went wrong. I agree that the stimulus was a pivotal point. I don't think this presidency is so wounded. I mean, I think the president's had better weeks and months than he's having right now, but I think it's too early to render a judgment. But I think the stimulus was a critical moment, and I my feeling at the time and now, I mean, this again, I don't have to run White Houses or strategize, so nobody's going to pay me to do that, and so I could just be completely impractical about this. But it seemed to me that stimulus bill probably has had some effect. It's very hard to prove a negative. That is, it's very hard to prove that the stimulus hasn't helped the economy or kept it from falling off a cliff. Clearly, voters are frustrated, as the caller is, that it hasn't had more of an impact. But I think part of the calculation at that time when they spent the $800 billion was that they had what they call a political blue sky. There was a consensus around spending. They had the majority to do it. They had the public support to do it, and they threw in everything. Some stuff was stimulative. Most of it was stimulative. Some stuff probably not so stimulative. Some long-term, some short-term. They sort of bought the idea that liberal economists will put forth that, every dollar the government spends is in some way stimulative, so just spend as much as you possibly can. And, of course, a lot of people felt they didn't spend enough. I think that was something of a teachable moment. Obama had a very high approval rating in the 60s, and I think that may have been a moment to say to the American public, I certainly thought this at the time, to say to the American public, look, all spending is not equal, and so here's the deal. Here's where we find ourselves. We've had this mess. We have a terrible economy. We have a collapse. There's short-term spending, which is stimulative. There's long-term spending, which is the investment to keep us competitive. There's tax reform, because we have a tax code that isn't 21st century or going to enable us to grow. And we've got to tackle all these things, and we're going to do this. Here's how we're going to do it over the next 6 months or 8 months or a year. Instead, they chose to sort of call everything stimulative and just throw it in one package. And I think it cost them a little bit of credibility, because I think the public feels a little cynical now that all this spending, some of which was easily caricatured, that it wasn't so stimulative, that there's no way to prove that it helped. And what it did was to sort of muddy the picture for the public in a way that I think it's been very hard for the administration to come back from.
Well, thank you so much for your call, Pat. And another call here from Claire. Hey, Claire.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have two questions. Why did Obama shut down the anti-missile program in Poland and the Czech Republic as soon as he got in? And why has he put Sotomayor on the Supreme Court? And she is challenging Roberts about our following the Constitution. Well, we should follow United Nations. Why?
I think Claire touching again on the fact that maybe he's not doing what a good progressive liberal would like Obama to be doing. Matt Bye?
Well, I'm not sure what that has to do with the missiles. Those are policy questions, Claire, and I can't really answer them specifically. I mean, certainly the president felt that had campaigned on the idea and believes that the sort of the Cold War foreign policy apparatus is not the best way going forward and needs to be reevaluated. Certainly he thought he picked a Supreme Court justice that was that was strongly progressive and represented an underrepresented community, I think, in the country. I think it's I don't think that that's the basis of where most people's concerns are about the administration right now.
We're close to the end of the hour here, Matt, but tell us what you're going to be writing about next and what you're going to be watching for from Obama, just to sort of see which way the tide is moving.
That's an interesting question. I mean, I'm writing, I'm doing a column now for the Times, Veronica, so I'll do some magazine stuff in the fall, but right now I'm writing a column for tomorrow's paper, hopefully, about this president and sort of anti-corporate populism, and you know, how he's sort of time and again gone after corporate entities in the country, and yet doesn't seem to reap any popular benefit from it. And why is that? And you know, I'm looking at writing in the next week or so something about deficits. This argument over cutting the deficit versus spending more, and why so much of the progressive base is really loath to talk about deficit cutting. You know, I think, you know, the question is where he goes in his next big sweeping initiative. I mean, I was surprised last night that he tried to pivot off the oil spill to go into an energy bill, because that, I don't know of a situation with that working in the past. I think it's very, very hard when you're on the defensive to suddenly think you can solve things by passing legislation. And I'm skeptical that that can work for them. But they do have to have another act after health care, a big single priority that he can rally the public back around. And you know, if you know, perhaps that is a kind of budget reform and deficit spending, but he has a lot of resistance to that in his own party. So, you know, financial re-regulation is almost done. So I think that, you know, what I'm looking to see whether they will be essentially adrift to the midterm elections, or whether they can sort of refocus the national agenda, get past this spill, hopefully stop the oil from leaking out, and then whether, you know, this president can really put something on the table that refocuses the political debate in advance
of the
election.
Well, Matt, I'm sorry we're exactly out of time, but it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Veronica. Glad to do it. Nice to hear from your callers.
Matt Bai from the New York Times. I'm Veronica Rickert on the Ideas Network.